Professor Hülsmann, Professor Nebo, thank you so much for inviting me here to the Center for Research in Economic Philosophy. Ladies and gentlemen, I look forward to an interesting evening. Hopefully, we can all take a step forward in our search for truth that brings us together here. For myself, I hope for positive criticism, if possible, although I'm well aware of the fact that the ambitious search, the ambitious sketch I have designed here is far away from full-fledged oil or canvas sort of a libertarian philosophy. As announced, the issue of the evening is the missing link or the developing Austrian economics into Austrian ethics, an outline. My objective in dealing with the topic is twofold. First, to understand the logical structure of Austrian economics and ethics, AE&E, and second, to reconcile Austrian theory with what I feel is a legitimate core of the concept of equality. First, in researching that logical structure of AE&E, it struck me as surprising that I could not find a clear account of the structure anywhere, although there's always much talk about stringent deductive logic, apodictically and a priori true propositions, and fundamental axioms. For example, Rothbard, in his preface to Man, Economy and State, announces, quote, "What I have in mind for a textbook would be a pioneering project. As far as possible, I would try to create an edifice, namely a logical step-by-step development of the Misesian theoretical structure," end quote. Alas, Rothbard does not expound in which way, using which axioms, which deductions and definitions, he intends to design that logical structure. For details, may I refer you to my article, The Third Axiom or Logic of Liberty. Footnote 20 here gives an overview of contradictory characterizations of the conceptual status of disutility of labor as a postulate by Rothbard or a deduction by von Mises, whereas footnote 52 in the present paper demonstrates that we find self-ownership as a deduction in Rothbard's Man, Economy and State, and as an axiom, even a fundamental one, in many other Rothbardian texts, most prominently in Ethics of Liberty. For Mises, by the way, does not seem to have used the notion of an axiom of action anywhere in his major works. Instead, he named it a category or an ultimate given. This has been widely ignored, and it has tacitly been assumed that the Misesian concept of action is tantamount to an axiom. Only lately, Oliver Cordova has demonstrated here at the Austrian Economic Research Seminar that the concept of action be purely analytical. So I try to work my way through some philosophical essentials of epistemology, but eventually I had to realize that not even the use of most basic terms like analytic and synthetic judgments is unanimous. I found that, for instance, Mises understands geometry to deal with analytic judgments, whereas Hoppe claims Mises to be a Kantian and that he subscribes to the existence of true a priori synthetic judgments with geometry as an eminent example thereof. For myself, I concluded not to take side in these quarrels, but instead revisited what I had earlier stated as a logical structure of AE&E. A similar inconsistency seems to prevail in respect to the questions: which characteristics qualify a theorem as an axiom, a definition, or a deduction respectively? What, if anything, is a distinctive feature of morals and ethics? Where is a demarcation line between ethics and economics? I've long been impressed by a simple statement by Antony de Jarzai. Quote, "If a thing is what it is and not something else," a clear enough proposition, "we ought not to call it by something else's name or describe it by something else's defining characteristics." It seems to me that by promoting clear thought, one not be doing a greater service to the good society than by promoting good principles, end quote. So let me state what terms I've come to see fit for describing the realm and structure of AE&E. These are by no means preliminaries, these are essentials for an unambiguous use of terms, although I happily concede that different uses of the same terms or different terms may be of equal or maybe even superior value. Pivotal above all is a concise and consistent use of clearly defined notions instead of a shimmering proximity. Now here's my set of conceptual terms, perhaps non-standard in some respects. Ethics is concerned with interpersonal interaction. It poses and answers the question of legitimacy and establishes norms. Norms as opposed to the rules, norms as opposed to conventions are rules that are without alternative given the rational nature of human beings and the affirmation of the will to life. These norms are the non-aggression principle and private property. Alternatives would not qualify as norms because they would not be universally applicable or were functional and, if applied universally, result in an immediate extinction of mankind. The method and form of ethics is cognition. Its statements are is statements and is concerned with objective matters of consent and coercion. Here I begin with my slides. Morals, on the other hand, are concerned primarily with intrapersonal value hierarchies, but also with those conveyed within society. Moral claims are conventional, that is, they have alternatives, and usually differ from one culture, ethnicity, or group to another in many respects and change over time. Instead of being universalizable, they may promote a differentiation between me and we and them. The subject of moral claims is the will. They are subjective, arbitrary, conventional, and may or may not be ethical. Moral statements are odd statements about what is regarded as good and evil. The term ethics is confined here to what may be called legal ethics or ethics of duty. What lies beyond may be characterized as love ethics or ethics of compassion on the one hand. But this is difficult to distinguish from morals in that the potential reach of compassion and the degree of compassionate action is basically unlimited. Without a somehow defined or smuggled in limit of reach, by distinguishing me and we and them, this claim for compassion amounts to a dysfunctional norm. On the other hand, one's disposition and dealing with truth, such truth versus self-interest, is an ethical category that may not fully be included in ethics of duty and love. Economics analyzes the interpersonal relationships of people striving to overcome scarcity of any material or immaterial good at any level. Methodologically individualistic and rationalistic, economics poses and answers the question of how goals can be attained. In the process of doing this, it finds that only what is ethically legitimate is also economically effective. In short, aggression does not pay. A definition is a proposition providing a short formula for a denoted complex set of facts. It does not disclose hidden content matter of a term and thus provides no additional insight. A material axiom is an is proposition that fulfills the following, to some extent overlapping, six requirements. First, it is self-evident in a reflective way rather than intuitively. Second, the material axiom is basic. That is, it describes a basic aspect of experience without presupposing complex concepts that tacitly imply unnamed preconditions. Third, it is a priori valid, that is, it does not depend on historical and external experience. Fourth, it is irreducible, meaning it does not follow from other propositions. Fifth, material axiom is universally applicable. And sixth, cannot be refuted without committing a performative contradiction. I will disregard the experimental and playful concept of the axiom as a random and arbitrarily chosen starting point for a formal construct, as well as the meaning of an axiom as a fundamental postulate. It is in this latter sense that Rothbard later describes the non-aggression principle as an axiom, which is a clear ought proposition. A deduction is a proposition drawn from the logical inference gained from applying one or more axioms on the particular situation. With this armamentarium, I compiled 10 definitions, 2 material axioms, and 12 deductions to be, by and large, an account, though not undisputed, of traditional Austrian economics and ethics. For due brevity, I skip over them all here, except for a few remarks on the issues of special interest, namely the deductions of ownership and self-ownership and the definition of rights. The self-deduction is property or ownership, namely by purposefully modifying resources found in nature. They become the property of the laborer, that is, labor enables exclusive control of use, alteration, and disposal. Possession of external resources is a necessary prerequisite for human as well as animal and plantal action. In particular, the term possession names an axis of man and matter in the direction from man to matter. I take this for instance. Generally speaking, temporal and local presence of material and immaterial entities is necessary for causal interaction. In distinct contrast, the terms of property and ownership refer to a rational concept, namely that of original appropriation of previously unowned goods and transferred titles. This is not just an arbitrary volition. Instead, only the intersubjectively ascertainable properties that the good bears as a consequence of the act of appropriation, that is, of labor mixed with it, indicates that the good is actually owned. In this sense, property designates a nexus oriented from matter to man. This book bears my signature, for instance. Even when this nexus is abstract, it is a rational concept rather than a factual case. Clear enough, only rational beings can exercise ownership. If you will, one can differentiate between ownership and the right to ownership. Usually, this differentiation refers to the societal aspect of rights that is negated here. The right is taken to be the rational affirmation of ownership, which in itself is a rational concept. A rational affirmation of a rational concept seems unnecessary, if not circular. So the habitual term of property right is just conserved here. The normative quality of ownership as the exclusive right of a person to control, that is, use, alter, and dispose of the good at his will, is demonstrated by Hoppe, acknowledging exclusive ownership to a person due to the act of homesteading and through title transfer is the only rule that enables conflict-free handling of scarce resources among rational acting men. Hence, property is a precondition in conflict-free acting of rational men entitled to the equal rank of their rights to evaluate in a world of unevenly distributed resources, both external and internal ones. So it can be stated, the concatenation of the two axioms of action and variety as formulated in traditional A&D with the axiom of human rank as formulated subsequently implies the concept of property. Thus, the complex notion of property or ownership is a genuine deduction from the action axiom, the variety axiom, and the human rank axiom, using some definitions and applying them to the situation acting man necessarily finds himself in. The status of ownership of property as deduction could not be built upon the action axiom alone. The interpersonal equal rank of the right to evaluate between competing uses of scarce resources, as expressed in the third axiom below, is a logically necessary element to prevent the latecomer from successfully claiming a superior right over the first appropriator. Now, property being deduced as a purposefully modified resource, enabling exclusive control, and right being defined as the rational affirmation thereof, we can proceed to ask, by whom can man rightfully be owned? To arrive at a stringent concept of self-ownership, two interrelated questions need to be answered. Excuse me. First, can man's will be controlled by anyone but himself? Second, is man's will alienable? So first, can will be controlled from outside? To the extent that man is a rational being, he is an acting being. That is, the rational is means, internal as well as external, to his ends. So even if his ends were from control by legally binding and successful alienation of his will, and B, if all external means were not in his property, he still and invariably is, as a matter of fact, the only entity to perform and control his inner means, be it organic or metaphysic. Hence, the first question is answered in the negative. Man's will cannot be controlled but by himself. Second, is will alienable? If by nothing else, man's will is subject to change by changing organic conditions. So even if, and as far as metaphysic means like intelligence or character, were irrelevant or successfully alienated, organic changes still largely determine the will, since you cannot dispose of and alienate what you do not actually have. Future will is inalienable. So it follows from the actual impossibility of control man's will from outside, and from the factual inalienability that man can command absolute control over his body's resources and thus can carry out his own freely chosen actions. With this being said, it is virtually unnecessary to rebut concepts of collective ownership in a person, or concepts even more out of context. The foreign control through ownership being thus excluded, the negative thesis of self-ownership is stated. But is positive self-ownership a stringent concept? This amounts to the question whether or not a person can be owned at all. Here I remind you of the deduced concept of ownership. By purposefully modifying resources found in nature, they become property of the laborer, that is, labor enables exclusive control of use, alteration, and disposal. Applying this result of deduction, we find that, yes, each of us human beings can and does purposefully modify resources found in his nature, his muscles and ganglion, for example, and yes, we all can and do exercise exclusive control of use, alteration, and disposal of our bodies. So man can be owned and can be owned by himself only. Hence, self-ownership epistemologically has the status of a deduction from the axiom of action, that it is manifested in purposeful behavior, but in addition from the axiom of variety, in that action at the same time presupposes and causes unequal distribution. And even more so, from the axiom of human rank, which is required to avoid conflicts of rational acting men. Subsequent deduction is that you have a right to evaluate. That is, we can rationally affirm that you cannot but evaluate, and that the source of our evaluation, the tertium corporationis, that we align all our evaluations to, is our body time. To introduce the third axiom of the human rank, which I claim to be a necessary extension of A, E, and E, you think of this kind of conflict situation? A single primary threat that affects the self-ownership of several bears has the right to evaluate. Zudem some striking examples, a current attack on a stateless society after secession, for example, by a state or a state embodying ruling power, a wildfire, a hostage situation in an airplane, or in particular, threatening to use weapons of mass destruction. The effect of secondary actions taken against such collective dangers can again be collective, even if according to each situation they can be maybe individually planned and executed. We will call them indivisible secondary actions. For those who are actually or allegedly primarily threatened in their self-ownership, it is possible to arrive at different judgments regarding the effectiveness of various possible indivisible measures of prevention, defense or containment without thereby getting involved in an ethical conflict. Those who are collectively threatened might, however, disagree with the assessment of the potential danger to self-ownership, which the secondary indivisible measures themselves pose to them and others, insofar as neither those dangers to life and limb arising from primary attack or threat, nor those arising from secondary defense can actually be allotted to one particular individual, we have a fundamentally different conflict situation, one that cannot be sufficiently described by solely using the two axioms of human action and diversity and precarious deductions thereof, namely alienable ownership of external goods. Of course, the attacker remains responsible for his attack, even if an attempt to defend may have aggravated him in the eyes of a tactical appeaser, or if an inadequate choice impeded an alternative and more effective measure of defense. However, the collective danger emanating from an act of defense itself will only be justified by those who rate this danger lower than the one arising from primary attack. This class of conflict emerges only where these centers are endangered or even damaged by a secondary act of defense, who would rather have accepted the original danger or would have preferred another but not concurrently possible defense. In that case, some action against the right for evaluation of self-owners and thereby an infringement of self-ownership is literally inevitable. This obvious dilemma raises the question of interpersonal value of competing rights. As interpersonal exchangeability cannot be assumed, equal value of self-ownership as a reference point of equally rightful evaluations cannot be deduced, but only be postulated as autonomous. Such an assumption rightfully claims reflective evidence. Otherwise, the requirement that every ethical maxim should apply equally to everyone would obviously make no sense, because this very demand of universal applicability describes the principal equality of all humans with regard to their conditio humana. This, however, one understands it, is based on the affirmation of life, that is, on the equal status of ownership of one's body, and thus on equality of self-ownership, as it otherwise would be a conditio sub domini servique. Taking into account the fact mentioned that due to the lack of interpersonal exchangeability, the term value, as stated in the seventh definition, is not applicable here, we will instead propose the terms of weight, validity, and especially interpersonal equal rank of bearers of equal rights. The statement thus phrased, the autonomous equal rank of interpersonal equal rights to evaluate, is intellectually self-evident, is basic, a priori, irreducible, and moreover, it is universally applicable. Yet the final criterion for attaining the axiom status is a self-contradiction in which the antithesis must inevitably become entangled. This antithesis would have to justify why the scale of values of one bearer of the right to evaluate should rank higher and why it therefore ought to be adopted by another non-consenting bearer of that same right. Whether or not the theorems discussed in the paper are the right antithesis, and whether or not the second really is self-contradicting, has to be left to further consideration. So that the axiomatic character of the statement of the equal rank of the rights evaluated can, for the time being, only be assumed. Since this phrasing is highly cumbersome, I suggest for convenience to name it the human rank. The scope of rational ethics seems to have been delineated by the statements made so far. As far as I see, all relevant interpersonal non-aggressive actions with regard to alienable and inalienable property have been categorically listed and sketched in outlines using an extended structure of axioms and deductions. The further deductions and definitions phonologically form this constitutes a particular subject of the science of economics. Seen this way, the logical structure described here should be approached as rational ethics. At the same time, it constitutes the foundation of economics. What implications the expansion of the axiomatic structure may have for economics remains to be seen. Although economics is concerned with alienable property, as the equal right of self-owners to value it is concerned with inalienable property, it may be expected that economic implications will result due to the situationally inseparable involvement of both spheres of property. What can be gained from all this? Outside the Austrian tradition, the more or less preconscious motive of defending perceived equality has led to bizarre twists in thinking. Recognition of their own species is part of the established behavioral pattern of all higher developed animals. But the attempt to transpose this biologically given equality into philosophical terms has obviously led to careless equations. These in turn have come into conflict with empirical data and thus fall short of formulating universal ethics. On the other hand, Austrian analysis of equality of certain aspects of inalienable property does not seem to have drawn too much attention. Even if John Locke actually had stated a similarly concise concise concept of equality and diversity, as has been pointed out to the notion of equal rank in my presentation, it would be about time to think it over anew after 324 years. As a consequence, quixotic as it may appear from a traditional point of view, I suggest to replace the contradictory ought propositions of liberty and equality with the bold if propositions of self-ownership and human rank. The traditional perspective is a longing but disbelieving view from the dried-out desert of ought, tired of all those mirages, to the fertile green pastures of this. At the same time, economics shifts close to ethics notionally. Categorically speaking, economics turns out to be nothing but applied ethics. One may hope that this can help to redress the alleged leftist conflict of fuzzy ethics and economics.